Hello, welcome to Sibline Insights. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and on today's episode, E.D. Lipton will be taking us through the current turmoil in Sudan. We'll be joined by Conrad Petraitis, who will talk about Argentina's current economic situation. And Sydney Stewart will join us once again to talk about water scarcity in the US. Please remember to like and subscribe. Okay, Edie, welcome back to the podcast. Sibylline put out an alert to our clients and subscribers on Saturday, I believe it was, just as things were kicking off in Sudan, seemingly. Can you take us through exactly what happened on Saturday?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Saturday, we saw the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF, take control of Khartoum Airport, a number of other airports as well. And we saw clashes between them and the Sudanese military in Khartoum, Darfur and Kassala.
So obviously it had wide ranging impacts almost immediately, but we'll talk about those in a second. What led up to what we saw on Saturday? Did we see this coming or did it come out of the blue?
Essentially, tensions have been building between the RSF and the military for a number of weeks. And just to give a bit of context, in December, a peace agreement was signed to ensure a transition to democratic rule in Sudan. And there were a number of issues that were left unresolved after signing that framework agreement. And that deadline was set for the 11th of April to have those issues ironed out. And one of those concerns were that the RSF needed to be integrated into the army, and essentially both sides had a lot to lose from that integration, which stalled progress in those talks, and then the deadline went past the 11th of April. Both forces were put on high alert across the country, so those tensions were really building since then.
At the heart of this, is this a political fight? Is it a battle for power between the two, you know, heads of the various factions?
Absolutely, yeah. Both leaders of the Sudanese military and the RSF have a lot to lose from losing this conflict. Now, they both have a lot of political and financial interests. They both also have concerns that losing this conflict now will result in them being kind of the underdog in whatever political agreement comes out of it. And what they're really worried about there is that they would not have immunity from some of the atrocities that they've committed against the population.
Sure, yeah. So just bringing us back to what happened on Saturday then and what's happened since, what have been some of the highlights on the ground? What have we seen? I heard reports of airstrikes and conflict in the streets. Exactly what has kind of happened in the, I guess, 7 days since we reported that incident?
So since the initial gains of the RSF on Saturday, we saw the army use airstrikes against RSF. They destroyed a lot of RSF bases across the country. So these airstrikes have caused a lot of damage to infrastructure. It's led to supplies being disrupted to major cities. We've got water shortages, food shortages. We've also seen looting on both sides. The UN office in Darfur was looted a couple of days ago. So that's likely to continue.
But a quite high threat environment, really seen to the medium term at least?
Yeah, absolutely. What we have is a lot of misidentification at the moment, which means that going out into the streets, there's a lot of crossfire, there's no front line. So it's very high risk for people at the moment. We think that the Sudanese military will make significant gains within central Khartoum, destroying those RSF bases, and that will allow more movement within central Khartoum, and that will essentially allow evacuations to take place from the central districts.
Well, thank you very much, Edie. I know that we are, you know, daily monitoring this. We're adjusting our risk scores accordingly. And of course, as things develop, we'll get you back onto the podcast. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Conrad, we've been looking at the economic situation in Latin America, specifically Argentina, for quite some time now. And the other day, I read one of your reports. I think actually in a conversation we had, he said Argentina's inflation is now above 100%, which is absolutely staggering. So can you just take us through, you know, where we are at the moment? Has it gone up even more since we last spoke? What is the current situation?
Yeah, exactly. So the last reading that came out, it was 104%. Just last month, it was clocked in at 100%. So there are, the trend is, it's not good. The trend towards hyperinflation, that's continuing. And that's worrying everybody, both inside Argentina and outside, specifically the IMF. They're still on the hook for a bailout roughly around the $44 billion mark, which is the largest bailout the fund has ever provided to any country. And inside the country, they continue to be stuck in this loop of commodity cycle booms, and then a lack of fiscal infrastructure and a lack of monetary responsibility that evaporates any income that comes into the country. And just a little boom and cycle we've seen in the last three decades, in the last two decades, we've seen three defaults. And since 1930, we've seen nine.
Right. So, I mean, Argentina is demographically quite a young country. Ostensibly, you'd say it's had all the makings of a very prosperous economy. So why are we in this situation now? Or indeed, why have we been in this situation for the last 20 or so years?
Well, in the last 20 or so years, so the 2001 crisis is really the inflection point. In large part because as soon as the crisis comes in and the government defaults, there is a huge exodus of the middle class that goes out of the country. And investor confidence hasn't returned. So you got both a good chunk of your economy departing, and then the investors have not, by and large, believe the government, that the government can hold, can be responsible for its spending. So in the last 20 years, it's roughly two groups who have governed the country. So we have Kirchner and his wife, who is currently the vice president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. She has very little credibility with anybody inside the financial markets. She's very famously been very hawkish, attempting to countersue and attempting to target people in the states that you know, trade in distressed Argentinian debt.
So it's a question of confidence then, really, in the regime. You mentioned about the IMF bailout package. Is that still pending? Or have Argentina received it? Just so I'm clear.
Yeah, so they've received it. We're in, I believe, a year in already. Yeah. And they're receiving tranches. The last tranche, I believe, was $6 billion that came out. And they'll probably continue to receive it in large part because the IMF has been bending its own rules and has been bending its own markers. You could argue for good reason. So Argentina's experiencing a drought right now, which is hitting soy and corn exports, which is a large part of the dollars that come into the country. But there's also mismanagement by the political class ahead of the elections that were coming up in October.
So this, $44 billion, do you think it will make a material difference to this, you know, the situation? Will it bring inflation down? Or do you think it will just, you know, it's just a Band-Aid for what is a structurally deficient economy?
It's a Band-Aid, to say at least. So as I was saying, there's no confidence in the current stock in government. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is the vice president, but the current president was second in command when her husband was ruling the country. And he's been involved in X amount of plots to fudge inflation figures and unemployment figures for a good long time. The people that might come into the country after October, They were the ones that catalyzed the last crisis, in large part because while they might have very good intentions, they did not have the political capital to rush through a set of reforms that would put in those fiscal constraints in place so that the country could finance itself.
So I guess investors are trying to see the lesser of two evils here.
Exactly.
I mean, we'll go on to the election and the outcomes and the forecasting in a moment, but how is this impacting businesses and organizations inside Argentina today?
So confidence, both outside of the market, which I've already touched on, hasn't returned. Inside the country, you could argue it hasn't returned either. I remember several years ago, I was at a large ranch outside of Córdoba, and the owner was explaining his expansion plans. His expansion plans, however, were in Miami. They weren't in Argentina. And more or less in the conversation, we said, well, you know, there's a new government coming, it's a lot market friendly. His explanation was the cycles won't end with one government coming. We need two, three successions of governments for that stability to sink in. That's in the long term. In the near term, what we're seeing right now, it's an immense spike in domestic unrest, for example.
Right.
There is also a worrying trend in the past couple of weeks. We've seen a rise in violence associated with protests, which is not common in Argentina.
Violence, what, between security forces and protesters or between factions of protesters?
Between factions of protesters and between protesters and government officials, which again, is not very common in Argentina.
Will this persist, these outcomes, these physical security risks that you just outlined, do you think they'll persist until at least the election? And the election will be maybe a way of blowing off some steam and mitigating and, you know, kind of assuaging this for the near term?
So our base case scenario is just that. They'll continue to rise. There is a lot of uncertainty considering whether we're going to see more violence associated with this domestic unrest. But domestic unrest and associated political instability will continue to rise until October. And then the vast majority of polls do suggest that the government won't be able to retain its control of La Casa Rosada, the presidential palace. So we might see somebody new come in, which might calm down the situation a little bit. But just as the anecdote I suggested, just one government won't make a tangible difference.
So it is the election, then what happens afterwards? Policy changes, and I guess it depends. The confidence in the government will depend on who comes in, right? Are there any candidates or parties that may garner more confidence than others?
Yeah. So regarding confidence from the left, you could argue the current finance minister, he has some credibility with the markets. His the rumors of him being replaced were in large part what spiked the black market or the blue peso, as it's colloquially referred to, just 2-3 days ago. So right now it's trading around 400 per US dollar, which is unprecedented. On the right side of the spectrum, there are two or three candidates, so a larger bench, I would say. All three of them would command some respect or some credibility with the market, specifically the IMF. And then we also have at least one other candidate that might be coming from a left field, a little bit more extreme right wing side. He has several policy proposals that might seem extreme, such as replacing the peso with the dollar, stuff like that. While some of the policy proposals do have some merit, his incoming would significantly spike volatility, specifically political instability. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, potentially optimistic outlook.
Yeah.
But I know we'll be keeping a keen eye not only on the election, but unrest and instability up to and including that time. And I know your desk will be reporting on it as developments occur. But for now, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
No, well, welcome back, Sydney, to the podcast. We've been reporting since, autumn last year on the current kind of water crisis in the US. And I know there's been some movement on that recently, but can you just take us through, for those, you know, viewers and listeners that aren't aware, and myself, what's going on, and what have we been reporting on since September, and how has it affected, you know, those states on the West?
Sure. So for a little bit of background context, the southwestern United States have been in a state of drought for approximately 30 years. This has been particularly acute in Arizona, Nevada, and California, as well as New Mexico. And this has impacted, you know, everyday life for families and people who live in these states, as well as for businesses and in particular agricultural organizations and agricultural output in particular. So what has recently happened is the Biden administration signaled in early April that it will move to impose a deal whereby it will evenly allocate water usage for the Colorado River among Arizona, Nevada, and California.
Okay, so you say evenly, right? So prior to this, then there was uneven access to that water. Is that the case?
Yes. So for the Colorado River, which provides water for seven states in the American West, a system was devised in 1922 that set out a system of water rights in which some states had seniority over others. This seriously disadvantaged states, in particular Nevada and Colorado, that had an extremely small portion of the total water allotment. I believe Nevada only had 4% of the total flow for the lower basin of the Colorado River.
Okay, so 1922, nearly 100 years later, mm-hmm. and you say, you know, these states have been in near drought for 30 years. Is it a silly question to ask why this hasn't been addressed hitherto?
Well, it's not a silly question. And in fact, this is not the first time that there has been attempted arbitration to rearrange this. There were Supreme Court cases dating back even to the 1960s in which Arizona sued California. And I believe Arizona also attempted to mount a two Navy ship battle against California, in which ultimately it all ended with a court arbitration. But this is not the first time that there have been attempts to kind of redistribute in a more equitable and sensible fashion the water rights. Mm. But this is going to be an unprecedented move. The federal government has never stepped in this way to unilaterally impose such a division.
And just talking about the effects, you're from California. In what way has this affected, you know, folks in your state and you know, let alone Nevada and Arizona? What's it manifested in? What's life been like for the last 30 years?
So, a lack of rainfall in particular has exacerbated the state of drought, as well as overuse. Basically, demand has continued to rise and rise, especially as, you know, urban metropolises like Los Angeles and San Diego and Tucson, Arizona, and Phoenix, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada, all of these cities have grown and grown, and populations have swelled, and so too has demand. And also, you know, perhaps non-sensible uses of water, people not acting particularly with a rationing mindset, has just simply meant that the supply has dwindled.
So given the low rainfall, will this measure by the Biden administration, despite climatic conditions, go some way to mitigate, you know, what we've seen, or, you know, is it, excuse the pun, a drop in the ocean?
Well, so the deal will, for some states, improve conditions and ensure drinking water supplies are there. But it also means that Nevada, Arizona, and California will each have to reduce their water supply by up to a quarter. This is as the Colorado River has recently seen its flow diminish by a third. So each state is going to have to make severe, severe cuts to their water supplies and water usage. Mm. This is likely to impose water use cuts on businesses and residents. This is likely to cause somewhat of a crisis for the agricultural sector, especially in California, which is responsible for producing half of the nation's agricultural output for produce, fruits and vegetables and nuts. And those, that industry in particular, is going to come under pressure to reduce their water supplies.
Okay, so not just bad news for hot tub producers then, but actually quite serious consequences potentially for the agricultural sector.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, do you think these states have the capacity to over time mitigate that, or are we going to see a near permanent drop in production?
I mean, I think it remains to be seen. Effectively, in the medium to long term, water scarcity is going to continue to be a fundamental issue that will come to define probably life and business in the Western, Southwestern United States, as it has been for, you know, the last 30 years. And it will, you know, continue to exacerbate other issues, climate change. And this last winter in California, we finally saw record rainfall, in fact, that has alleviated some of the drought pressures. Many regions of California have actually had their state of drought go from extreme and acute drought to more moderate or even to a low drought condition. So we have in the near term seen kind of an easing due to just the sheer fate of having high rainfall this last winter. However, in the long term, you know, these cuts are likely going to outweigh that rainfall that has accumulated in the short term. And this is also going to impact not just potentially food security, but also energy security. The Hoover Dam produces electricity for Arizona, Nevada, and California. And the Hoover Dam is reliant on flow from the Colorado River. So if we can, I mean, ideally, this plan by the Biden administration will, in the short term, ensure that things like the Hoover Dam can continue to produce a hydroelectric power and avoid that kind of worst case scenario where it shuts down entirely. But, you know, long term, we'll hopefully see, you know, a stable condition, but dependent on other conditions.
Well, a bleak picture, but I'm sure we'll keep on top of it. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Gareth.
Well, that's it for another edition of Sibylline Insights. Thank you to Edie, Conrad and Sydney. And of course, thanks to you for tuning in. Please remember to like and subscribe however you're receiving this podcast. And we look forward to welcoming you again for the next episode.